Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 7th of May, these are our main stories. Vladimir Putin is sworn in as Russia's president for a fifth time, promising victory in Ukraine, as reports come in that a sophisticated plot to assassinate Volodymyr Zelensky has been thwarted. Israel has stepped up its military operation in southern Gaza. And the latest on the collapsed building in South Africa, where rescuers have made contact with survivors under the rubble. Also in this podcast, celebrations to mark one of the most enduring pieces of classical music, 2 centuries after its first performance. We start this podcast in Moscow, where President Putin's quarter of a century rule over Russia has now been formally extended by another 6 years.
Владимир Владимирович Путин.
The ceremony took place under the lavishly gilded domes of the Kremlin's throne hall in front of an invited audience. Washington and the European Union are boycotting the Kremlin ceremony, although France and some other EU states were expected to send an envoy, despite a plea not to do so by Ukraine. Taking the oath, President Putin insisted he was open to dialogue with the West, but said it had to be on equal terms, and he was unapologetic about Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
It is a great honour for me to address the homeland, and particularly to the heroes of this special military operation, those who are fighting for the homeland. And I thank you very much for giving me your trust and confidence. I am grateful to every citizen of Russia.
I asked Vitaly Shevchenko, who's the Russian editor at BBC Monitoring and who's seen many of these inaugurations, for his thoughts about what President Putin had said, particularly mentioning the war in Ukraine right at the start.
I have to say that very little stood out for me. He said exactly what I expected him to say. One thing that's slightly different from the way he normally does his big speeches, he acknowledged that Russia is going through a difficult period. He said we'll move through it with dignity. So that's not something I would have expected him to say 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was more about good news, we're doing well, we're going to do even better. This time around, he knows that Russians are watching how the so-called special military operation is unfolding. They know tens of thousands of Russians have been killed, and he has to respond.
And there was a sense that I got from it that he was trying to portray a Russia that is under attack morally. He talked about Russian values. How popular will that be amongst a certain percentage of the Russian people?
Oh, it will be popular, and it's a point that percentage of the Russian people will have heard and embraced before. We are fighting for our very way of living, our traditional values, as President Putin called it. And it's a way of justifying his policies and, yes, the war against Ukraine. If you turn on Russian TV, you will hear quite a lot about how the West is imposing its decadent values on countries like Ukraine and Russia. No, Russia isn't going to be very different.
He did say, look, we are open for dialogue with any Western nation. But then the caveat was, on our terms.
My question would be, does he mean it? A lot of what happened and what was said in the Kremlin today isn't necessarily what it seems. So the Kremlin says Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin won an election, it was inaugurated, but so many people would hesitate to call what happened in Russia earlier this year an election after freedom of speech was all but obliterated. All the key political opponents of Vladimir Putin are either in exile, in jail, or dead. If you challenge the party line, you're going to get fined, arrested, or worse. So how free and fair is that election? Not very. And he was inaugurated with his right hand on the Russian constitution. And in his oath, he swore to respect and defend human rights and citizens' rights and freedoms and defend the constitution. But if he opened that red book on which his right hand rested, it says things like censorship is banned, freedom of thought and freedom of speech and freedom of assembly are all guaranteed. And that's not exactly the kind of Russia we are seeing right now.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, was at the ceremony. Here's his assessment of how Vladimir Putin has changed in office and how he's viewed after nearly a quarter of a century in power.
Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin.
It was 24 years ago today. Vladimir Putin walked down the red carpet through the Grand Kremlin Palace on his way to taking the presidential oath for the very first time.
Мы обязаны беречь достигнутое, хранить и развивать демократию.
That day, he promised to preserve and develop democracy and take care of Russia. As Vladimir Putin embarks on his fifth term as president, Russia is 2 years into a war he's waging against Ukraine. A war in which Russia has suffered heavy losses. While at home, instead of preserving democracy, Mr. Putin has been curtailing it, jailing critics, removing all checks and balances on his power.
Now he's the king of Russia, and he pretends to be the king of the whole world, and he wants this world to exist according his terms, according his rules.
Andrei Kolesnikov is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center.
This is closer to totalitarianism than to authoritarianism, because Putin wants not simply silence of the population, he needs complicity.
On paper, at least, this version of Putin is popular at home. Officially, he won more than 87% in the March election. But he'd faced no serious challenger in a vote widely seen as neither free nor fair. So how do Russians view a leader who increasingly styles himself as a modern-day Russian Tsar? To find out, I drive to the town of Kashira, 70 miles from Moscow. Here, a gigantic Putin portrait, a massive mural, takes up one whole side of an apartment block. In Kashira, Big Vladimir is watching you. I like him, says pensioner Valentina, who's selling flowers by the roadside. Putin has good ideas and does a lot for people. True, our pensions aren't big, but he can't fix everything in one go. But when I ask the next passerby, Alexander, what he thinks of the president. It's dangerous now to express an opinion, he says. No comment. Most of the people I talk to here say they walk past the Putin mural without even noticing it now. They've got used to it, just like they've grown used to one man running Russia.
Steve Rosenberg reporting there. In the midst of the bitter war between Russia and Ukraine, assassination attempts on the leaders have always been a possibility. And now it seems a plot to kill President Zelensky has been thwarted. For more on this, I spoke to our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
Plots on President Zelensky's life, these assassination plans, are common ever since the full-scale invasion when Russian paratroopers tried to descend on the presidential palace to take him out. But this is a plot which really does stand out. You have the country's intelligence service arresting two serving colonels in the Ukrainian security service, which is responsible for keeping institutions and officials safe. Now, it is alleged that these men were hired by Moscow before the full-scale invasion as moles in a meeting in neighbouring European countries where large sums of cash were transferred. And their role, their planned role, was to leak details of President Zelensky and other senior officials' routes, travel routes, security details, as well as the addresses where they stayed, with the aim of them being struck by a Russian missile. But the detail keeps coming. It's also alleged that they took large amounts of weapons from the Ukrainian regions they were serving in to Kyiv to carry out this attack. They included mines, explosives, as well as drones. So it really is a plot which has it all, but it really is a reminder of the risks that President Zelensky, a war leader, faces.
Indeed. I mean, you say these are allegations, obviously, at the moment, but they're serving colonels. Now, if the allegations are proven, it's deeply worrying for the authorities there, isn't it? Particularly, perhaps, given that perhaps money may have played a part in it.
You would think so. And what we won't find out, I don't think, is how close these men got. But the tone that the intelligence service is trying to strike is that we've watched them all along and we didn't let it get too far down the line. But of course, this is something that Ukraine will be all too wary of. This is a country with a history of corruption, which it is grappling with. And there have been reforms in some areas, but it's a stark reminder of what President Zelensky faces.
James Waterhouse. Despite months of talks about a possible ceasefire in Gaza, a deal still seems as elusive as ever. On Monday, Hamas agreed to a deal, but Israel now says the terms don't meet its needs. The exact details of the plan remain unclear. Meanwhile, overnight into Tuesday, Israel carried out its most intense bombardment of the city of Rafah. The UN says its access to Gaza's Rafah crossing is being denied now by the Israeli authorities. Louise Waterich is a spokesperson for UNRWA, that's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in Gaza.
The last 24 hours have been a complete rollercoaster of emotion. Even the last few days, there was so much hope for a ceasefire. Anybody you speak to here, the last week, the last few months, every day, all they want to know is when there is a ceasefire coming. And it's what everybody has been hoping for. So to wake up yesterday morning to the devastating news that leaflets had been dropped and an evacuation order was in place, it really spread a lot of fear across the community. I'm currently in Western Rafah, but across Eastern Rafah, people started to move. But even outside my window, I was able to see people starting to take down their makeshift shelters, start to pack up and start to leave Rafah. So there's a lot of fear spreading. As the day has gone on, I've seen again more and more vehicles move out of the Rafah area as people are packing up their things and leaving. Clearly, people are hearing the situation at the Rafah border crossing and now deciding to leave once again. The Rafah crossing is the biggest and the only entry that UNRWA, the largest humanitarian agency here in Gaza, has been using. And now there is no aid able to get in. And in addition to that, there is also no fuel. So fuel is really what the agencies need to run this massive humanitarian operation across the Gaza Strip. Fuel is what's needed to run the trucks, to get the aid to the people who need it. Fuel is needed in the generators to run the hospitals and health clinics that are remaining and not damaged and destroyed. So without this fuel and without these aid supplies, the aid operation here is simply going to ground to a halt.
I got the latest on the Israeli military action from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell.
The Israeli military said in a briefing to journalists this morning it had taken control of the Palestinian side of the only crossing between Gaza and Egypt, the Rafah crossing. And we've seen footage already of tanks rolling into that crossing. There were certainly many airstrikes overnight. You could see the smoke rising up on the horizon still this morning. People told us that there were flares lighting up the sky constantly overnight. Israel says it's killed 20 Hamas terrorists in its operation in Rafah. It's found three tunnel shafts. Palestinians saying that, you know, many innocent civilians have been killed. There was a man talking about how he'd lost his wife and children. As far as the Israeli military is concerned, this is a very precise and limited raid of Rafah. That's what they've been saying to journalists. It's not the full-scale ground offensive that, of course, the US and others have warned Israel against because of the humanitarian consequences, because of the high numbers of displaced people that are living in that city.
It may well not be the full-scale assault that many people are expecting, but as we heard from that humanitarian spokesperson, it's causing problems with little aid or fuel getting in at the moment.
Yeah, this has really closed the Rafah crossing for a start so that people will not be able to cross in and out. And that is a crossing that has been important for aid organisations as well as those Palestinians who've been able to move. And at the moment, we also have the Kerem Shalom crossing closed after rockets were fired by Hamas, the Israeli military says, from inside Rafah on Sunday, killing four Israeli soldiers close to the Kerem Shalom crossing. That is the main commercial crossing for aid. So this, although the Israelis say that they're going to look at how to open the Kerem Shalom crossing as soon as security allows, this is an extremely worrying time for humanitarian organisations and, of course, for Palestinians in that area, because it's now become extremely difficult to get supplies in to Rafah, which is where you have about half of the population right down there in the south of the Gaza Strip.
Meanwhile, Yolande, the diplomacy goes on. We are rather in the dark, aren't we? Hamas accepted this ceasefire agreement. We don't know exactly what was in it. It's been rejected by Israel, and yet Israel is now sending another delegation for the talks.
That's right. And it's a moment where, you know, prospects for a ceasefire deal really do look to be hanging in the balance. You've got the Qataris also sending their negotiators back to Egypt because they've been involved in the mediation effort as well. And it's a confusing picture. I mean, the devil is in the detail of this deal, and we don't get to see, you know, in full exactly what Hamas has agreed to. There was one unnamed Israeli official who was briefing journalists that this was a watered down Egyptian proposal, something that Israel couldn't accept. There were parts in it that it rejected outright, but other officials being quoted saying that this was not very different from the Israeli deal laid out at the end of last month, which the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken had said was extraordinarily generous.
Yolande Nell. May the 7th marks the 200th anniversary of the premiere of a work that is widely regarded as one of the great masterpieces of Western classical music, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It was first performed in 1824 in Vienna, where the German composer lived and worked for most of his life. The anniversary is being marked by several performances of the symphony by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Riccardo Muti. Bethany Bell reports from the Austrian capital.
It's a work that touches me on so many different levels. It's an outcry for peace. It's an outcry for unification. It's an outcry for brotherhood.
Daniel Froschauer is first violinist and chairman of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra.
It's so many things at the same time. You know, obviously it's also the European anthem. It's a piece that just touches my heart every time I play it. It never leaves you cold. The beginning, for example, when you don't know, you know you're in D minor or major, it's not declared. It just immediately takes you in a different cosmos.
Beethoven himself helped conduct the first performance of this symphony, despite his increasing loss of hearing. In the orchestra were musicians who would later go on to become founding members of the Vienna Philharmonic. The musicologist Otto Bieber says the symphony was revolutionary.
It was a symphony, but with something new in the fourth movement. There was a choir on the stage, and the choir starts to sing, and there were soloists on the stage, and they were starting to sing. There were so many new details. Very difficult for the musicians and very experimental. And he had the idea, I have to open the door to the future. As a work left by Beethoven for the next generation.
You're lifted up. At the end, when you're singing, you're just lifted up, and it's wonderful.
Heidrun Irene Mittermeier sings alto in the chorus. She says the symphony moves from the darkness to the light.
Everything is like exploding in joy, exploding in light and happiness and being friendly to each other, so that not one bit of this darkness is any longer here. And I think Beethoven had a lot of darkness in his life. And I think with this Ninth Symphony, he overcame it.
Still to come in this podcast.
It was so electric and so charming, and like I just had the best night of my life, I guess.
How major music artists are turning their attention to India.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
An Australian woman who's accused of murdering her in-laws by serving poisonous mushrooms in a beef Wellington has pleaded not guilty. Erin Patterson from Melbourne is charged with 3 counts of murder and 5 of attempted murder. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports.
Erin Patterson has always maintained her innocence, but this was the first time that her legal team said she would be pleading not guilty to all charges against her. Now, the charges relate to a lunch that she put on at her home in Leongatha, which is a town a few hours' drive from here in Melbourne. At that lunch, she served a beef Wellington with mushrooms, and attending that lunch were her in-laws, as well as her mother-in-law's sister and her husband too. Now, after that lunch, all of the guests fell ill, and 3 of them subsequently died. The 4th guest in Wilkinson, he was in a coma before recovering. But the police said that it was alleged that she fed them death cap mushrooms. Now, also invited to that lunch was her former husband, Simon Patterson. He did not attend. Now, the charges against her are 3 counts of murder and 5 counts of attempted murder. And they also include previous alleged attempts against Simon Patterson's life. Now, also decided at the hearing was that the case will be fast-tracked to the Supreme Court. That means that a trial will come sooner rather than later. And the next hearing is expected in this court here in a few weeks' time.
Katie Watson. Emergency services in South Africa have made contact with 11 construction workers trapped in the ruins of a collapsed apartment building in the coastal city of George. At least 5 people are confirmed dead and dozens are missing after the 5-storey building, which was still being built, fell to the ground on Monday. Colleen Diner, the Chief Director for Disaster Management for the Western Cape region, gave this update.
We're in contact with 11 people. We have one area where 4 people are in a basement, and we've been communicating with them. So that's quite a big operation. It'll take them most of the day to get them out.
Well, for more, I spoke to Shinga Nyoka, who's been to the building site in George, and a warning that the signal of her phone is rather patchy.
There are 2 specific areas that the rescuers are looking at, and I saw that firsthand. A lot of the focus right now is on the basement area, so there's a lot of excavation that's happening there. And earlier on, you know, there's a lot of noise. There are excavators as well as cranes that are pulling concrete as well as scaffolding from these ruins. And at one point, one of the team leaders put his hand up and said, quiet. And then there was silence and they pulled somebody out, and that person was taken to the hospital. And there's 7 ambulances that are there with stretchers waiting. And so I think there's hope that they will be found alive and that they will be rescued today before the day ends, before it descends into this chilly winter night. But some others that were pulled from the rubble had unfortunately died. But this is a small fraction of the number of people that are still buried underneath this five-story ruins. 75 people were on site, we understand, most of them construction workers, and the majority of them are still underneath the rubble.
Shiganyoka. Researchers trying to name all those people killed in the Holocaust in the Second World War have made a series of breakthroughs using AI technology. The findings were revealed as part of Israel's Holocaust Remembrance Day. The newsroom's Jessica Wilkins has its report.
Artificial intelligence may help identify more victims of the Holocaust. Researchers in Israel are using AI to comb through piles of records. Names have been found by reading through statements and documents, checking film footage, cemeteries, and other records. They hope to find details of people who were killed by the Nazis, but whose names were missing from official records. Esther Fuchs-Brumme is from the Yad Vashem World Holocaust Remembrance Center.
We were able to collect 4.9 million names, and we're trying to reach 6 million.
The center has already begun using AI to find vital information about those who went missing. Names go into the center's database of those killed in the Holocaust and is then matched with existing data.
That technology works very fast. It takes a few hours to go over hundreds of testimonies, and it's very exact, the results. A human being wasn't able to do it when human beings used to go over. We had volunteers that went over those testimonies. They missed out a lot of information.
So far, AI has been effective. Out of the names found, 90% have been new. One such name is Ruth, a four-year-old girl bound for Auschwitz with her twin sister.
Yehudit survived. Ruth was killed, was murdered. And we were able to bring more information about Ruth from someone that's not her family at all, someone that met her in the camp. And we believe that way we'll be able to be a lot of stories about a lot of victims that were killed, little kids that no one else knew to tell us a story about what happened to them.
That report was by Jessica Wilkins. It's often noted that when major international artists plan their world tours, India has been left out. That's now starting to change, and more musicians like Ed Sheeran are heading there to try to break into the multi-million dollar market. Megan Lawton has this report.
Last month, 50,000 people headed to the Mahalaxmi Racecourse in Mumbai. They were there to see Ed Sheeran. He sang in Punjabi for the first time with Indian singer Diljit Dosanjh. The video went viral with more than 50 million views. Sachin was there and enjoyed every minute.
It was so electric and so charming. And like, I just had the best night of my life, I guess.
And Ed Sheeran isn't the only one to play on that stage. Over the last 12 months, the Jonas Brothers, Royal Blood and even Westlife have all energised India's music scene.
About 13.5 million Indians are stepping out for events on an annualised basis, outside of movies.
Ashish Hemrajani is the co-founder of Book My Show, India's most popular online ticketing platform for live events. They put on shows, as well as sell tickets across sport, theatre, live music and cinema. Over the past 10 years, India's entertainment landscape has rapidly changed from one that's focused on movies to music. Since 2022, live music has been Book My Show's fastest growing category, contributing to 25% of their revenue. Ashish says the weather can be a challenge.
It's a country where 6 months of the year, it's either too hot or it's raining, and you'd rather be indoors. And there aren't any indoor venues for live entertainment.
But that's something they're trying to change.
One of the things that we're doing is taking earlier created infrastructure for sports or cricket and seeing if we can use it as a multi-use venue.
As well as building new stages and developing better transport routes, India has also scrapped tax on all event tickets less than $6. That's made a big difference to people like Arjun Sagar Gupta. He owns The Piano Man, a music bar with three venues across Delhi.
It just makes the entry point for a potential audience member easier.
Arjun believes the growing appetite for live concerts in India is partly down to music becoming more accessible.
When we were kids, we were at a shop buying cassettes and CDs, and we were at the beck and call of the distributor, what they decided would move in India.
But now, he says, streaming platforms like Spotify and Apple Music have changed all of that.
You have access to every kind of music from every part of the world.
India also has a ready-made base of young music fans. More than 40% of the population is under the age of 25, according to Pew Research Center. But they're still waiting to see some of the biggest names in music perform live.
I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Beyonce and Taylor Swift haven't yet added India to their global tours, but the music industry and their fans there are hoping that will change very soon.
Megan Lawton reporting there. And to hear more about that story, just search for Business Daily wherever you get your podcasts. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles and until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.